I got my stuff. Got my Cash's corrections. All we're missing is we need somebody to warm that seat right there.
Yes.
Somebody to warm up that seat.
Somebody whose name begins with Scott?
It rhymes with Scott.
It rhymes with Scott.
Shall we count it down?
Yes.
Again, we didn't say anything funny.
Oh, we got plenty of lead in there.
I'm looking at Kaz. Mm. That's funny.
Oh.
Oh, okay. Oh. Hey, that works. You can count it down now.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I'm James Wygant, associate editor of the American Stamp Dealer and Collector, and you're listening to Stamp Show Here Today.
It's hard to send up. It's hard to send up.
Stamp collecting happens when we dream together.
Welcome to Stamp Show Here Today, episode number 63. I am sitting here with Scott Cash, and on the Marcel Sleeker commemorative microphone, Jeff, and I am your host, Dawn. Thank you, Marcel.
Thank you.
You can find us on Facebook at Stamp Show Here Today and on Twitter at Stamp Show HT, or you can call us and leave a message at country code 1-949-873-4298. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes, Podbay, Stitcher, and many more. Let's talk about stamps. This week we'll be talking about stamp news, a statistical preview of World Stamp Show 2016, hashtag stamp stories, Freaks and Errors movie update, Cash's corrections, and our expert topic this week is on quill stamps.
Cool. I think I'll stick around and listen to it.
That would be advisable.
Yeah. Doesn't sound like it's boring like all the other ones.
Oh, I mean, we have so many listeners. It's not like it matters if you listen to it.
So, stamp news. World Stamp Show 2016 is upon us. For mountain climbers, the ultimate thrill is the summit of Mount Everest. There are no higher peaks to climb. For stamp collectors in the United States and all around the world, the equivalent of summiting Everest will be attending World Stamp Show New York 2016 in New York City. This monumental, once-a-decade philatelic extravaganza opens May 28th at the Jacob K. Javits Convention Center and runs for 8 days through June 4th. Perhaps you're wondering what to expect from the show. Here are some of the statistics and facts.
Not just statistics, but facts.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
Hey, we give it all right here.
Yeah.
More than 200 dealers are expected to attend the show. Many of them have been preparing for months, searching for new and exciting stock to entice collectors of all levels and budgets. It's highly likely that you'll be able to complete your want list at NY 2016.
No, that, it's not.
Yeah, I know.
But you know. How dare you, sir?
You know something interesting, though? Well, I saw at Orco Expo, a lot of dealers are actually picking up large stocks to take to New York that they're going to try to turn around there. Yeah.
Well, not only that, I went to Washington 2006, and you know, they said the same thing. You should be able to complete your want list. And yeah, no.
Yeah, but you're special. Your want list has some pretty crazy things on it.
Yeah, but some of those things, there's no way in heck I'm going to be able to afford them either.
Yeah.
Well, you can at least add. Some 60 societies and specialty organizations will have displays on the show floor, conduct membership meetings, and present lectures and seminars on a broad spectrum of topics. Best of all, most of these meetings are open to the public, so bring a friend along.
Or a spouse.
Or the public.
Or a kid.
Or a kid, yeah. Crying babies are highly recommended.
Just leave your kidnap victims at home. Don't force anybody to go.
Ooh, Dawn gave Cash a look.
Oh, no.
Competitive exhibits spanning just about any subject you can think of will be on display in 4,000 exhibit frames. There will also be around 500 frames housing non-competitive exhibits. In addition to the exhibits, there will be a court of honor displaying some of the hobby's greatest and most recognizable rarities, including the unique 1856 one-cent magenta of British Guiana.
I want to see that.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Otherwise, I'm still hopeful, but I am expecting that the higher the award, the more boring the exhibit.
Well, it's funny with the magenta, though. I was thinking about it, like, okay, so it's probably going to be in like foot thick plexiglass.
Well, when they had
guards,
well,
there'd definitely be guards.
Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely. When they had the Z grill, I remember it was inside of a little box, like a vault, and you looked through a little lens to see the stamp in the back of it. It wasn't in an exhibit frame. It was literally you were looking into the vault and seeing it.
That's crazy. I mean, okay, you steal it. Now what?
Yeah.
When I There's one of them.
Well, there's... We were watching YouTube on paintings, stealing paintings. And art theft is... There's a huge amount of art theft. And it's never recovered. And you think, well, if you steal a Monet, you know, what are you ever going to be able to do with it? And the answer is you put it up in your house and then you sell it, private treaty and stuff like that. You make sure nobody finds out about it. So, you know, somebody could get the 1 cent magenta just to have it, and he would be the dude with it, although he wouldn't be able to tell anybody.
Nah.
No, I agree. It doesn't hold any interest to me either, but...
It happens, like you said, though, in the art world.
I don't know. I think a lot of stamp collectors are like me. They like to talk about the stamps they have.
Yeah.
And if you had that stamp, you would be talking about it.
You'd be so worried about it getting damaged. It's never, you can be like sitting at a table with friends go, ah, look at what I got.
Well, if it ever does get ripped off, I'm going to, you know, then everybody gets boasting rights to say that they have it, except for the person who actually does.
Well, I saw it in 2006, and it wasn't under that much security. I mean, there were two armed guards, one on each side, but you could actually get up to about 10 inches away from it to look at it.
Well, back then, the Z-Grill was worth more.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
it was?
Yeah. Oh, so the Z-Grill was worth more than the 1 cent magenta. Now the 1 cent magenta, because it just sold, is worth way more than the Z-Grill. But you know, you're going to have a $9 million little piece of paper there. It's got to be protected.
Yeah. Well, it's the most expensive thing by weight in the world, isn't it?
Yes, by far, by far.
More than 50 postal administrations, including our own U.S. Postal Service, will be open for business at the show, offering their latest new additions and other specialty products. The show's organizing committee expects more than 200,000 collectors, their families, and friends will visit during the course of the 8-day show. A show this size needs an enormous amount of space, 294,000 square feet to be exact. WSS New York 2016 will be spread across the cavernous Level 3 of the Javits Center in New York City. And the best news? Admission to the show is free.
Cool.
Yeah, but getting there is exactly.
expensive. That's the hard part. It's in New York.
Yeah, but on the plus side, you can sleep on the street.
Oh, there. Okay, good. Yeah.
Is that normal there?
It's not abnormal. I think most visitors tend not to. But a lot of the indigent local population does.
I remember when I used to go to game conventions. We would sleep in the convention center. We'd like curl up underneath a table and fall asleep. But, you know, I was like 17 back then.
Now at your age, people look at you kind of weird.
now at my age, I want a real bed with a pillow on it.
And you need me after show closing? I'll be under the table at Coast Philatelics.
There you go.
Okay, time.
Poor joke.
Okay, let's move on. Okay, time for hashtag stamp stories, hashtag freaks and errors. Just how far would you be willing to go to get the last stamp you need for your collection? Mark Schwakala, producer and director of Freaks and Errors, the movie, had a chance to sit down and interview Stuart Weitzman, the current owner of the Penny Magenta. As Mark stated in his latest project update, we talk stamps, Americana, and what drives someone to collect. He has some great insight as to why hobbyists do what they do, as well as his personal reflection on what collecting means to him. In addition, we discuss what $9.5 million buys these days. Man, that's a lot of money.
Isn't it?
It's even a lot of pesos. It's a lot of yen.
It's a lot of dong.
Yeah.
Mark also went on to say that while the movie is nearing completion, there is still quite a bit of work ahead of them if they are to meet their deadline. Hopefully the movie will be done in time to be screened at World Stamp Show 2026.
God, is it Friday?
Wow. New York 2026. Book your tickets now.
Oh Lord!
Hey, you can never be. You can never be. You know.
You
go plan ahead.
You get what a hell of a discount if you book your room now. Yeah.
I think that's supposed to be Stamp Show 2016. I think somebody did a typo.
I think so.
Space, the final frontier.
Not around
so
here.
So much for proofreading.
And 10 points to Gryffindor.
Oh, yes.
Hey, I was thinking about lunch, okay?
Maybe they'll have it ready for 2016, huh? Mark told us, our next steps are to comb through footage, which we watch in real time. This is essential for the assembly, or pre-rough cut. As we do this, we notice holes that need to be filled. We are scheduled to do a follow-up interview with Neil Steinberg and are setting up a stamp shoot to show stamps like they've never been seen, using macro lenses to get into the very texture of the stamps and postal history.
That sounds boring, actually.
Hey, really? We look at stamps up close all the time like that.
Yeah, macro lenses to get into the fibers and stuff. I, as a matter of fact, it's funny, there's a YouTube picture of a stamp that they took the picture of the fibers of the paper,
mm-hmm.
and it looks like a hay bed, a bed made out of straw or something like that. Very interesting.
Anyway. Well, if you don't have context and really a lot of things to compare it to, then there's really it really is boring.
Yeah. Well, it just the description there, the macro lens to get into the very texture of the stamps. It sounds interesting. Yeah, exactly.
I'm sitting here trying to justify it. Well, they could be talking, you know, looking at wove paper, you know, versus laid, and who knows.
And that's like going to make just a really super interesting movie.
That'll be riveting.
It'll be riveting.
It's prime time right there. You know it is.
Watching the fiber lay of different paper manufacturing processes.
So do you think this is going to beat Star Wars for the box office?
Oh, you know it.
It'll later, be educational George. And informative.
And at the end, we'll blow up a stamp.
Cool. Now I want to attach stamps to something that blows up.
I know. Me too. All of us at Stamp Show here today can't wait to see the movie when it's completed. Hopefully, you are looking forward to it too. Let us know your plans to see this groundbreaking movie on Twitter and Facebook, hashtag Stamp Stories, hashtag Freaks and Errors. Cash. Corrections?
Well, hail fellows, well met.
Not a correction.
I have just one small thing. It was funny, too, because I was listening to the last podcast, and I said if I had 50 Harding first day covers, I'd make a cachet. What I meant to say really was that if I was dishonest and I had 50 covers, I would make a cachet. It's not that I make cachets. As a matter of fact, other than the Leonard Nimoy cachet, I really haven't made one in years and years. But it was always fun. I enjoyed very much making the event covers I did. Otherwise, I trusted everybody did their search and found out what a mountain chicken looked like.
Oh, God. If you haven't figured it out yet, it's a frog.
It's a freaking big frog.
A big frog.
Yeah. Chicken-sized frog.
And after that, I've really got nothing.
What?
That's it.
Usually this is like a 10-minute segment.
I know. I'm falling down. Other than mountain chickens and not making cachets, I'm pretty boring this week.
Any more midget jokes?
Midget jokes.
Oh, my goodness.
Hey, that's a pretty small thing of you to say.
Oh, no, Jeff.
I look at it this way. We have more time now to speak about the expert topic.
Ooh,
that's true.
And then everybody listening can get on with their life quicker.
Ah.
Oh, boy.
And now our expert topic, all about quail stamps. Coil stamps were first produced in limited quantities as specimens and proofs in Peru as early as 1862, but but didn't become mainstream until the turn of the century. Many stamp collectors have at least one coil stamp in their collection, and many collections can feature quite a few. However, most collectors aren't up to date on the history of the coil stamp, and some find them difficult to collect, especially when so many fakes have flooded the market. So, exactly what is a coil stamp?
A coil stamp is an attached, well, they don't have to be attached. They're stamps that were sold in strips, basically.
More like coils?
Yeah.
They like were sold in coils.
One high or one wide in long strips, usually coiled into a roll, sometimes numbered, sometimes not, sometimes made from perforated stamps, sometimes specially made, either from special plates or from sheet stamps and then trimmed. But they were actually issued in that format, and so therefore they're considered a separate issue.
What changed in postal needs that made them necessary?
It was more convenient. Part of it was convenience. And along with coils goes booklet panes, which were convenient for more for me and you, like the private customer. But coils were necessary more for the speed of business. You had a business would put out a mailing, and they created machines that would automatically affix the stamps to the envelopes. And so they needed a format of the stamp that was easy for the machine to handle, and that's where the coil comes in. The coil dispenses it, wets the adhesive, and basically applies it to the envelope in a process, and it is much quicker than having somebody sit there and separate the stamps and stick them to each envelope individually.
So the thing I was thinking with vending machines, so it sounds like vending machines were kind of a secondary byproduct then.
Well,
but
actually,
that was the main use.
Actually, the vending machines kind of the stamp vending machines were different. They would dispense the stamps at a sale location, usually the post office. But the equipment to process these outgoing mailings was created, and then that created the need for stamps, and the Postal Service had to react to that. And at first, it was just by supplying imperforate stamps, which then the company that would do the affixing would cut those into strips. And then later, the government got into producing the stamps actually as coils.
Well, what would happen? Stamps started in 1840.
Mm-hmm.
They really didn't take off until the 1850s, and then prices went down.
Well,
they lowered prices.
They took off because that's when prepayment became compulsory.
Well,
instead of
it also became cheaper.
Optional.
I mean,
it became cheaper because it was compulsory, and then because of scale,
mm-hmm.
it became cheaper.
Well, from 1800 to about 1850, the inflation rate, and I'm talking about the United States mostly. I have some statistics from Britain and some other European places, but mostly this is a U.S.-driven show. I apologize to our foreign listeners. But between about 1800 and 1850, the inflation rate in the United States was pretty close to zero. In the early 1800s, it could cost anywhere from 12 cents to 33 and a third cents to send a letter. In 1851, it dropped to 3 cents. It dropped to one-tenth the price. So all of a sudden, you have people starting to write more letters. With the U.S. Civil War, you had a lot of people dislocated from their houses. And so all of a sudden, everybody started writing letters. All these soldiers and their soldiers' wives and everything were all writing letters to each other. At the end of the Civil War, mail became mass industry. Over the next couple of years, up to the 1880s, you start seeing businesses saying, hey, you know, we've got this new medium, exactly like we're doing right now with computers,
mm-hmm.
you know, with email and everything. They're going, can I use mail to advertise, to sell stuff, to make money? and they started figuring it out, and they got the 1 cent unsealed circular rate. And if you think about it, so you want to send out 100 envelopes, you buy a sheet, you rip it up, you start licking and sticking. What happens when you want to run 1,000 or 5,000 or 10,000?
That's a lot of tired tongues.
Right, exactly. So at the turn of the century and a little later, some people started saying, you know, I'm ripping these stamps into strips and then licking each one and sticking it on an envelope. Wonder if they came automatically stripped, and you have these stamp affixing companies, of which Shermack was by far the largest. And they made these machines that you just sit there and you go, chucka, 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 chucka. And every time it chucked, it would put a stamp on an envelope. And you could put stamps on 5,000 envelopes in a day. All of a sudden, one person, one machine did 5,000 envelopes and didn't wear their tongue out.
And it was maybe a few hours, not
In actuality, yeah, it was hours. So what they did was they went to the post office. And they said, hey, we have this need. We will buy a massive amount of stamps from you, but you have to give it to us in this format.
Oh.
And the post office said, let's see what we can do. And they had some experiments when did the 1 cent and 2 cent coils come out, the Third Bureau issue? That was like 1904?
The series came out in 1902, so the coils were probably 19. Anywhere between 1902 and 1904.
Yeah, so then all of a sudden you have the post office actually going to industry and saying, yes, we will give you what you want. And that continued on through the 1920s, where they were experimenting, trying to figure out. Sometimes the post office just said, screw it. We're not even going to perforate these things here. Just take them imperforated, run them through the machines yourself, and that's where you get the private purse.
Oh, all those weird Shermacks that are there for just a little bit of time and
exactly.
then disappear.
And those weren't even perforations. Those weren't where the stamp was supposed to be separated. That was where the claw of the machine hit to push the stamp forward.
Oh, it's like little rectangular box type threes?
Yeah, it's little rectangular boxes so they could push the stamp through it. That wasn't where it was. That's why when you see Shermacks, you know, a lot of times they're cut where those two squares are. But most of the time, they are not. And that's because
not most of the time. A lot of times, they're not.
Yeah, a lot of times, they're not.
But a lot of times, they are.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, you'll have those two little boxes.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you picture them as actual perforations for, you would have half of the two boxes on one side, half the two boxes on the other. What you tend to see instead is two boxes on one side or the other, but very seldom both.
A little bit of a remnant on one side, maybe.
What would happen is those were for advancing the coil through the machine, and then and then at the edge of the machine there would actually just be a knife.
And it would just slice off.
And since there was a separation between the mechanism that advanced the coil and the cutting mechanism, if it advanced it, it would generally advance it the space of one stamp.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was adjusted slightly off,
the syncopation got off a little.
It wouldn't necessarily cut it where the holes were. It would cut it to one side or the other. And so...
Probably at the beginning of the day, it was set up so it would cut exactly on those little things and it was all nice. At the eighth hour, they were going, who cares? Just run them through.
Wow, that's a little bonus side note. Now I know where Shermack's came from.
Yeah, so those were coils too. Now, those are...
those were made from imperforate sheets, and the sheets were cut into strips. And the strips were actually hand-pasted together.
By the post office, not by the company.
That's where you get a paste-up pair, right?
Right.
Yes.
So the post office would pay these ladies, because it really was done by ladies, and they would strip the sheets and then glue them all together and then roll it all up and sell it. And the post office, like I said, you would go to the post office and say, I want these. And there's many examples of coils that the post office produced for just one person,
or one company,
like the famous Orangeburgs. Supposedly, there's a 6 cent coil out there. Somebody needed a 6 cent coil. Nobody has ever seen any used, but the order was placed, and they don't know if it was fulfilled. So, you know, these people were ordering, and this person probably had a heavy item, He said, it's 2 ounces. I need a coil roll of sixes. And the post office said, sure, hey, Henry, run that machine over there. They ran them off, stripped them, glued them together, and handed them to the guy.
So then I take it then that that evolved eventually. Wait, how did it switch over where the post office specifically started perforating them and producing them as such? Because after a while, it normalized, and you get rid of all those private perfs.
Yeah, at both times. But what happened later on, of course, is that the perforating machines, or I'm sorry, the affixing machines, they didn't need their own private stock.
Well, one thing
they could use any stamp.
Right. And one thing is, when the government started producing coils, the standard gauge for the U.S. was perf 12. And the coil machines, to advance, would pull on the roll, and those perforations would separate. So the
all the time.
Which is why the perf 12 coils, why the government didn't produce those for very long, because the companies didn't like them. And so they would prefer to have the imperforate stock and run those through their machines.
So is that why then for U.S. coils, the perforations seemed to change rather quickly over a less short period of time? They were experimenting with what worked?
Exactly.
Exactly.
Because I know they did 12s, and then they did 8.5s, and then they did 10s, 10.5s, 11s.
Well, the 12s was the general gauge for all stamps. Then they went to 8.5 with the coils, and that worked okay, but it was a little bit too stiff.
Mm-hmm. There was too much paper.
Right. And so when they went to 10 for the general issue, everything went to 10.
And oh, then, okay.
And then when the general perforations went to 11 or 10.5 by 11, the coil stayed at 10 because 10 worked really well for the coil affixing machines.
So, okay, I think I know the answer. What was the first official U.S. coil stamp?
I'm glad you said U.S. because I have no clue what the world was.
Government perforated?
Yeah, it would have to be the 1902 issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know which one came first, the 1 cent, 2 cent, or 5 cent, but it would have been one of those.
Well, it would have been the 1 cent or the 5 cent.
Yeah, yeah.
Is the 1 cent the Franklin?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so
and
that
the 5 cent is Lincoln, and the 2 cent is Washington.
The 2 cent is the Washington Shield issue, not the original issue with the 1902.
Right.
Those guys, I've noticed, those can be pretty pricey items if they're genuine.
Yes.
Major pricey. Yeah, we'll talk about some of the fake stuff later.
Very few were produced, very few were saved, and part of the reason that there weren't a lot produced is because they did not work well in the machinery at the time.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
Well, if you think about it, like a Shermac,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's got those two rectangles for their perforations. That leaves a lot of paper to hold those stamps together.
Yeah.
Whereas a perf 12. You maybe have a quarter of the paper left, maybe even less than that.
Yeah, there's less than what you've taken away in perforating it.
Yeah, I mean, you can have plate blocks and, you know, just mishandle the plate block and it'll bust apart.
Yeah, I've seen that, actually.
Yeah.
So are they manufactured at all the same way now?
Not really. Now you have them, their self-sticks.
Well,
and they're put in giant rolls of like 3,000.
Originally, those stamps were printed on a flat bed press,
mm-hmm.
And so each impression of the plate was basically a large sheet of 400 stamps. Those sheets were then cut into strips and pasted together.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have the rotary press stamps, and you have these huge rolls of stamps that are continuous, and you might get 500,000 stamps on a coil if you didn't cut the coils into smaller segments.
And now rotary was where they took that flat plate and they wrapped it around a gigantic drum, right? So
correct.
They could continuously print.
Correct.
Correct.
Because I know in looking at 4th Bureau, Washington, Franklin stuff too, big difference between rotary and flat plate.
Right.
And so it's when the plate would get stretched in that process.
Right. And then they went from rotary press production to a sheet-fed rotary press to a roll or a continuous roll-fed rotary press.
Now, do they still print them excuse me, do they still print them in big giant sheets and then slice them up, or are they print it individually, like in a single strip?
Well, you
or?
Still print them in a sheet, and then you just have a slicer that slices them and rolls them into big giant rolls.
At the back end of the production stamp printing, there is a section that then slices that big large roll into little tiny strips. And then it's kind of interesting when you see a picture of it. Then there's a little coil winder at the end of each one of those strips. Mm. And it winds the coil to a certain length, and then it cuts it off.
So paper towels, but on a much smaller scale.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, one of the interesting things about the flat plate is they printed them. They would print the sheet. There would be four sheets on a plate. They would be divided by a line. They'd have selvage at the top, bottom, left, and right. So when they cut them, you'd have 10 stamps, and then you'd have a line, and that's a guideline pair. That's different than what we'll talk about later.
Those lines were actually etched into the printing plate and were printed on the
sheet. Then it would go two more stamps, and you'd have selvage. Then they'd take that selvage, take the next strip, lick the top of the stamp, stick it to the selvage. So the selvage from the first sheet would hold the first stamp from the second sheet. So that stamp would be a paste up. Then you'd have 10 more stamps, you'd hit a line. 10 more stamps, you'd hit selvage. Then they'd take another stamp, lick it, stick it to the selvage. And then they'd just continue doing that for as large as the roll was going to be.
So we've been talking a lot about U.S. coils. I know Kaz is kind of itching to talk about other countries, too. So what other countries have interesting coils?
Oh, well...
a lot of countries have coils.
I mean, well, today every country has coils.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
There's still a few out there that don't.
Grenada doesn't.
I was just going to say, the countries that actually send mail have coils.
Sweden has a boatload of coils. Yeah. They produced almost everything in coils and booklets.
Right, wow. Right. But the early Australia, I always thought was cool because they perforated their coils differently. Their coils, the holes, are different sizes. They get larger in the middle and smaller at the ends. So one of the big problems with coils is how to fake them. You know, you chop off the perforations. Well, if you chop off the perforations on an Australian stamp, you look at the top row, and it's going to all have the holes the same size, whereas they're not. So they shouldn't be. If they do, they're fake. So that's a really good way of being able to expertise those, and it's interesting in that they did it that way, just to address, like we're saying, how do you hold these stamps together? And they found that having large holes in the middle probably, I mean, I'm just guessing here, but probably somebody had a machine that wanted that bigger hole so that the little gripper could push the stamps through.
Oh, yeah.
Or something like that. Otherwise, they can't really see a reason, you know, why the post office would bear an expense to perforate these differently.
Other than a security feature.
Yeah, but you're securitizing what?
Yeah, I mean, if you're making something out of a genuine stamp anyway, you're not really defrauding the government. You're only defrauding the collector community. Yeah.
Then you're only making fakes as opposed to counterfeits.
And then Germany and Britain, they made coils, but what they did was they took sheet stamps and just tore them into strips, basically, or cut them into strips with the perforation. So they'll have perforations on all four sides and still be a coil. The way you those, there's various ways to do it, but Germany is easiest because you turn it over. You usually collect Germany in strips of either 12 or 13. I forget what the number is. But over that stretch, you're going to have a number or other tells that tell you that that strip is...
Those are every fifth stamp.
Something like that, yeah. Or in this case, you know, a sheet is 10 stamps long or wide.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a strip that's 11... you know that's a coil.
Oh, okay. So that would explain the high numbers.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's why there's different ways, different countries collect coils. And sometimes, like I said, to prove that a stamp is a coil, you just have to have it a longer strip than a normal sheet would be.
Well, at least in the U.S., coil stamps, and I know other countries, some other countries are like this. You basically have two opposite sides that are straight edges, and then two, the other two sides opposite are perforated.
Mm-hmm.
Germany is one of the countries where it was the coil stamps were actually perforated on all four sides.
Correct, yeah.
Well, Germany just printed stamps weird anyway. I have Germany sheets where there's different stamps printed on the same piece of paper.
Oh, yeah. Switzerland is weirdos. That way. Cool, too.
Well, Ireland's coil stamps are that way.
Yeah.
They wrote strips of three, four, or five, and they're different denominations from this series. Well, and they repeat, but that's what their coil
stamps. Yeah, I collect Switzerland, like. And this is booklets, not coils, but, you know, you'll have a 10-cent stamp, and underneath it you'll have an 8-cent stamp, and then next to you you'll have an 8-cent stamp upside down, and then above that you'll have an 8-cent stamp right side up.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have very interesting layouts, and some of those layouts become very, very expensive because mm-hmm. of the lack of production of them.
I have a pair of German stamps, the in-between period of World War I, World War II, where it's like that. And it's mm-hmm. kind of expensive because it's two stamps, different denominations, as a pair across from each other, but one is upside down mm-hmm. compared to the other one. So it's a kind of a unique little item.
And that was a... Typically, they would cut those into booklets
mm-hmm.
or something. And so you just got one that wasn't cut.
Or it was miscut.
Or it was miscut. And you would... you know, get it out of the post office because at some point the post office just didn't care and they said, mm-hmm. here, buy these stamps.
Yeah, stamp's a stamp.
Yep, exactly. Israel has those also a lot for booklets. You can buy uncut booklet sheets which have stamps upside down next to each other.
So, coils can be a very sticky subject for collectors because there are a lot of fakes. Why are there so many fakes?
Well, let's step back a moment. One of the reasons why I think people don't collect coils is the same problem that you have with the Roman states. If something is highly counterfeited, you have to know what you're buying, otherwise you're going to get ripped off. In the Roman states, huge, huge, huge amounts of those stamps were reissued. Now, the first issue was never reissued, but the first issue suffers in price, too, because the later issues, nobody knows that the first issue wasn't faked. It's the same thing with coils, except with Roman states, you had a printing company that was out there printing fake stamps. With coil U.S. stamps... A six-year-old with a pair of scissors can fake the stamp. And if a six-year-old can fake a stamp, it becomes a question of, you know, how much time am I going to devote to learning
mm-hmm.
how to identify those? Which is why you listen to this podcast, because we're going to give you the secrets in like 15 minutes.
Okay. Along with what Kaz said... In the early 20th century, when the U.S. started producing government-produced coils in the Washington Franklin era, we're talking these were produced by flat plate printing, which means they were the strips were pasted, hand-pasted together and all of that. When they came out, the collectors didn't like them because they had straight edges. Now, I know in many countries, especially over in Europe, they like straight edges because it will prove a certain place on the sheet where a stamp came from. But over here, our collectors don't like straight edges. They prefer fully perforated stamps. So the collectors at the time did not see these as separate issues. They saw them as damaged stamps. And so they didn't collect them when they were issued. Only later did they become... they realized that they should be separate issues. They should be collected, and so now they're playing catch up. So the used stamps weren't saved. The mint stamps weren't saved. They were all used up, and so now you have a lower population of stamps because a lot of collectors at the time let them go by, and then they had to play catch up. Well, that in addition to the six-year-old with scissors. Being able to fake them makes them easy target for counterfeiters to try and make a whole bunch of money. And so the genuine ones tend to be expensive, but the catalogs cannot reflect that because there are so many fakes in the market. It brings the prices down because, frankly, people aren't just willing to pay a large sum of money without some assurance that they're buying what they're paying for.
Yeah, I've noticed that with U.S. flat plates. You can easily, I'm not advocating this, I'm just explaining what happens a lot. You can take a stamp that's worth a couple of bucks, a flat plate Washington Franklin, cut the perfs off, and now it's a $60, $100, $200 stamp.
Especially if it's from it's got a big top straight edge. It's got a straight edge someplace.
Oh, yeah.
And so you have one straight edge already cut. You just have to cut off the other one.
Well, one of the things, by the time the rotary presses, the rotary press printings of the Washington Franklin started coming out as coils, these weren't issued regularly as sheet stamps. So that's about the time when collectors started realizing, hey, these are actually different issues. They're produced differently. They're for different purposes. And so they had to go back when the rotary press issues came out, they had to go back and collect the flat plate issues. So you do see a fairly good amount of the rotary press coils. They're rarely faked. There's not a whole lot of basic stock to make them out of either. And so those are fairly easy to collect, and you can be fairly confident in what you're buying that those coils are actually genuine. It's the flat plate coils earlier that are more scarce and much more frequently faked. When you have a sheet stamp with the same perforation gauge where you can just trim off perforations, that's a problem. When you have imperforate stamps that you can just add perforations to, that's a problem. And speaking of that, in the flat plate era, the U.S. Postal Service actually did issue full coil rolls of imperforate stamps.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still buy those, and guys that are faking these things do buy those coils, and they perforate the whole roll. Well, I bought a strip of 8. It has to be genuine. No, it doesn't. Some guy that's got no scruples, no morals, took an imperforate coil, which is actually kind of unusual. You don't see them that often in the market. And he destroyed it by adding the perforations and making a fake item, and now it's just not worth anything.
Well, except that the person will buy it and actually pay him a bunch of money for it.
Yeah.
What you were bringing up, the difference between flat plates and rotary, like I said with Roman States, you know, the first issue was not faked.
Right.
So, but people, it drags down the value of the first issue. Same thing with coils. And the rotary coils were not faked. So you can buy them and be assured that they are real. But the prices are dragged down because of flat plates. And, you know, Scott brought it up. You know, when I first was working with these, I always thought that these were always faked by cutting off perfs.
Mm-hmm.
It never occurred to me that, no, it wasn't them cutting perfs off. It was them adding perfs to imperforated stamps. And that, to me, was when we expertise here, we get somewhere the perfs are cut off. But we get far, far, far more where the perfs are fake by probably, I'm going to say 10 to 1.
I was just going to ask you.
It's probably even higher than that. Although, when you're talking about the very first early coils, the Scott numbers 314, 315, those you see a preponderance of trimmed stamps.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you get into the Washington Franklins, absolutely, adding perforations is the much more frequent fake that you find.
I mean, just to give our listeners an idea, we get thousands of stamps here a month. Probably about a quarter of them are coils, people trying to sort their coils out. What would you guys say if you had to assign a percentage? What percentage of the coils we get do you think are genuine?
If they come from just a normal person clearing out their book,
versus
I'm going to guess 20% are real and 80% are fake. If it's coming from a dealer, dealer's a little bit smarter, but still, I'd say even with a dealer, with the smarter dealer, they're still 50-50.
So then you could probably average that out and say probably 40% of the ones we see are real.
Yeah.
That's pretty bad. If 60% of them, six out of every 10 we see.
But you got to remember that out of all the coil stamps we see, maybe only 30 or 40% of those are flat plate coils.
Well, that's true. That's a good point.
Or less.
Well, no, but here's the real killer. What we see isn't a true representation of the market.
No, absolutely not.
It costs $30 to get a cert. If you have a coil, and I think 333 is a coil? First coil? What's the 1 cent coil? The first 1 cent coil?
Which?
The Washington, right?
The Franklin head.
314?
No, the one after. The fourth bureau issue.
Well, you want the 8.5 or the 10 or the which one you want?
Well, anyway, that one. The first one from the Washington Franklin series.
You want the 12, 348.
348, thank you. 348 and 349 catalog, I believe, $12.
What?
Yeah. Higher or lower?
349 is higher, for sure.
How much higher? Because the hitch is that it costs $30 to get a cert. And I know that these guys do not catalog $30. And even if they did, you wouldn't want to pay $30 for a $30 stamp. So we don't get these lower values. And that's where the fakers kind of make their money, is it's not worth sending in for a cert. So if...
Oh, okay.
So we see the expensive stamps, and out of the expensive stamps... Two-thirds of them are getting bounced out. Of the cheaper stamps, I'm going to guess, and I'll bet you my number is really, really close, 80% are fake.
Real quick to clarify, I found it. So a 348 pH is $40, but Scott was right. The 349 pH is actually $100.
Oh, okay. But still.
So it's 40 and 100.
Yeah, so, but again, spending $30 to find out if a $100 stamp is real is tough. Mm-hmm. And spending $30 to find out if a $40 stamp is real is, you're never going to see
it. You're going for a grade at that point.
Right, exactly. So, you know, we see a lot of number 409s. That's the common stock that all this is made out of. Number 409s.
Well, 344, 384,
but
343, 383, 408, 409. Yeah, right. All the imperfs.
But for me, I see is if you can make it out of a 409, it's common. And 409 is, I think, what the base stock for a lot of this fake stuff is.
At a 2 cent Washington?
It's a 2 cent Washington. I mean, we just see so many of them that have the perforations added, all different gauges.
Another thing with the flat plate coils, they don't generally come super well centered. And so if you're looking out there and you see something that just looks too good to be true, it's just really perfect centering, everything's bang on. That's something to at least be suspicious of. I'm not saying they don't exist, because they do. But it's just something to be suspicious of.
Yeah.
It's like finding, you know, you're walking down the street and you find a $100 bill. It's just too good to be true sometimes.
That goes perfect, because my next thing I want to know, so we're disparaging the crap out of coils. They're a pain. How do I protect myself? How do I make sure I'm getting legitimate stuff when I go looking for them?
Number
one is cert.
Second of all.
Because even education, sometimes you get...
Well, no, but you protect yourself through education, through certification, and from buying from a reputable dealer. Because a reputable dealer will take it back if you get a certificate that says it's fake.
That's true.
They're reputable because they have a reputation to protect.
There you go.
Right. So education, certification, and a reputable dealer. That's how you protect yourself.
Interesting. You guys, is there anywhere people can go? I know stamp information is scattered all over the place. Is there any good one or two reference points for correctly identifying coils and if they're real or not?
Well, here's the number one reference point. And this is one that is always, you know, pull out a millimeter gauge or perfection gauge. Sorry, mm-hmm. Perfection. By the way, anybody out there who doesn't have a precision gauge. If you don't have one, spend $10-$12, whatever it is, and buy one. When you get it in your hand, you will be shocked at how great this thing is. Well, anyway, over on the side, there's a little millimeter gauge. And if this, now I'm speaking round general terms. If it is 21 millimeters wide from straight edge to straight edge, in other words,
21 and a half.
In other words, it's a vertical coil. So the straight edges are on the sides. If you measure from straight edge to straight edge, it should be 21 and a half.
This is for U.S. coils.
For U.S. coils.
That's the standard width. They can be smaller and larger, but to protect yourself, it's good to see at least 21 and a half millimeters.
If you see 20 millimeters run from the stamp, it could still be real.
Don't run from it, but be very suspicious.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then if it's a horizontal coil where the straight edge is on the top and the bottom, you want to look for 25 millimeters.
Correct.
Now, again, there are lots of exceptions, but that's a good rule to go by. Just a starter, if you don't learn anything from this podcast, if you just remember 21 millimeters by 25 millimeters. 21 and a half millimeters by 25 millimeters, you will have gotten some value out of it.
I know we use my favorite book. I don't remember the author, but it's called The Expert Book.
Paul Schmid,
The Expert Book. They're expensive if you find them because they're out of print. Wonderfully magnificent book. It's about 350 pages, somewhere in there, 350, 400.
They're $80 to $100. It's basically identifying Washington Franklin's.
I've seen them as low as 10 and as high as 300.
Well, they're at 10 because somebody doesn't know what they have.
Exactly, yeah.
It's usually like 80 bucks. That's right, what I see.
Yeah, if you buy it from a bookseller, you can usually find them in the $80 to $100 range.
They've got a really cool section on there actually talking about fakes for each of the rarer stamps that says this stamp can be made from the following Scott numbers. Here are ways to tell the difference if it's that stamp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's an excellent starting point.
And some of those things are things that just the average person can do without, you can figure it out just from reading the book and comparing a few items. There are other techniques in there that are more difficult and require a little bit more experience and maybe even some coaching from somebody who does know what they're looking at. But it's a good place to start. It's a good reference if you're going to collect the Washington Franklin's series of U.S. stamps.
It's also got a really cool section at the back that I use all the time. Well, I used to. I have it memorized now, but how to tell all the different 2-cent Washington types apart.
Yep.
So it is worth every penny when you get that book. It's got so much knowledge in it if you're interested in these stamps.
And we're not going to, first of all, we've already done it, but second of all, it's too long a topic. We're not going to talk about how the perforations are put in. But reperforators have a very difficult time duplicating how the post office put the perforations in. If you want a really good write-up, I'm going to give a plug to our book, which is The Book of Secrets, Volume 1, not Volume 2. Volume 1 has a better write-up than Volume 2 does on this. Go to gradingmatters.com. Look for Volume 1. I'm going to guess it's like 10 or 12 pages of how to detect fake perforations in stamps and coils.
I would recommend to people too, because it's how I started. When you find a fake, buy it, especially if it's an obvious one, just if you need it for reference, because you go, oh, now I know what bad perfs look like. Oh, now I know what it looks like when somebody chopped perfs off. It's not a bad thing to pick them up if that's what you're doing it for.
Oh, another thing too is if you can find two real ones, find a real one that's 21 and a half millimeters, another one that's 25 millimeters, and just put it on top of the one you're looking at and say, this one is clearly not the same size as my genuine one. Therefore, I am going to question whether this is authentic or not.
You can Google. There are little tutorials, actually, on how to make cheapy gauges to actually do just that out of the actual stamp. I've seen that. So you can look that up on how to make one of those. It costs like $2 for each stamp to get the right size, and it's like 10 minutes of work each. And now you got this little pocket-sized gauge you can take around with you to compare the size.
Yeah, they put them on the end of a little popsicle. The one I saw was on the end of a popsicle stick.
Mm-hmm.
And it was half a stamp on one end and half a stamp on the other end, and you just set it on top of it. And what it was is, I forget what the number was, but they said, this stamp here, there is no way to fake it. Mm-hmm. So just buy this stamp. It's cheap. Chop it in half, yep. and you have your measurements.
Yep.
And it's obviously a rotary stamp. But, you know, some rotary stamp that was never faked, there's your reference.
Yep.
Any questions, Don, since you're the novice of the group?
Well, I'm learning to be an expert. I'm reading Book of Secrets.
Make Cash pick them up for now. Make Cash pick them out for now. The right stamps.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Find all those fake dragon stamps.
Yep.
At this point, that's okay. Because then I'll learn.
Yeah.
Right?
As long as it doesn't cost too much.
Right.
There is a cost to education. It's not free. But you just try to minimize it with stamps.
Mm-hmm. Book of Secrets, $10.
Yeah, it's
15,
worth it.
15 if you get both.
I mean, I've seen, I can't tell you how many people I've seen at shows that are just heartbroken because they think they've got thousands of dollars worth of stamps and maybe one out of 30 is legitimate.
Well, we were talking about the 1 cent Benjamin Franklin, the 1902 coil, and a person had found the very, very common number 301. Mm-hmm. It was the postcard stamp. Billions of them were printed. And he found one, and he went online, and he saw that that same stamp, didn't know the difference between a sheet stamp and a coil stamp. So, you know, clearly it was a coil stamp. He saw it was worth $115,000, and he came running to us. And it was so funny because he brought it in, and it was all wrapped up in a big piece of toilet paper so it wouldn't get damaged. I'm going, that's not how you keep a stamp from not getting damaged. And he said, oh, you know, is there some secure place we can go so I can show you what I have? And I said, well, let's just give me a look at and see what it is. And he pulled out this little 1 cent stamp that was not only not a coil, it was not 100% of the stamp. It was like 90% of the stamp. It was missing pieces and toned and faded. And I just had to say, you know, stamp collecting is a little more difficult than just seeing a picture online and seeing that that stamp is $175,000 because that stamp is. Your stamp is not. And so, you know, stamp collecting isn't easy. But I think if it was easy, it wouldn't be nearly as interesting either.
Yeah, there'd be no challenge.
Yeah.
Right.
But finding coil stamps, in the United States are scarce. Some of them are rare. Their values are highly undervalued in the Scott's catalog, and that's because the demand is low because people do not know if they're real or not. If you want to buy some true underpriced rarities, look at the rotaries because the rotaries were not faked. And, well, very, 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 very rarely faked. I mean, the chances of you finding a fake rotary is really tough. If you find these rotary stamps in nice condition, well-centered, nicely used, or mint never hinged, you have some major rare items that are terribly underpriced in the Scott's catalog based on their scarcity. So it does pay off to learn about coil stamps.
Well, another thing is I sat with a dealer recently that had bought what he described as an old-time collection, and the person had stopped collecting in the early 1970s, and that person's grandfather is the one that had bought most of the stamps. So basically, most of the stamps were bought in the early 20th century, and he was of the opinion that because the collection was stopped being added to in the 1970s, that all of the coils must be real and genuine, and they weren't. And maybe a third of the coils were genuine, and we're talking about the flat plate coils. So even then, obviously they weren't added in the early 20th century. They were added a little bit later because as soon as the coils started getting recognized as separate issues and being collected, that's when they started faking them. There was no lag time.
And like I said before, all you need is an 8-year-old with a pair of scissors and you can start faking these things.
Sometimes, yes.
I'll give one last little plug to Specialty Gauge 2 on that related topic. One thing I found on there that has been invaluable enough practice and you get to where you can tell by eye. But for now, if you're beginning out, the difference between rotary and flat plate, the size difference is literally microscopic. To measure it, you have to look through like a 10x loop with a ruler in it to figure out the difference. There is a gauge on the specialty gauge that teaches you how to line up to tell the difference between flat plate and rotary, and it's incredibly accurate.
Yeah, and it takes like 2 seconds to do.
Yeah.
For the U.S., the difference is typically about 0.75 millimeters.
That's how close it is. So rather than worry about your eyesight, just get a specialist gauge. And
or trying to measure it.
Yeah, that's hard.
The template is the second best way to go. The best way to go is to get a flat plate stamp and create your own template from it. A cheap, inexpensive flat plate stamp works as well or better.
You can email us at stampshowheretoday@gmail.com, Twitter stampshowht, Facebook stampshowheretoday, and our website, www.stampshowheretoday.com, with your questions and comments. You can now leave your questions and comments on our Google Voice answering machine anytime, 1-949-873-4298. There is also a link to Google Voice on our website so you can make your call from your computer. And on that note, keep collecting.
This is Leland Wolf with Wolf Stamps from Sacramento, California, and you're listening to Stamp Show Here Today.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you not only by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, but also by the Philatelic Book of Secrets Volume 2. Volume 2 covers even more secrets. It can be bought alone for $10 or together with Part 1 for $15 at gradingmatters.com. Get yours today.
Hi, this is Bobby Prager with Gary Posner Incorporated, based in Long Island, New York, and New Jersey. And I just want to say that the stamp hobby is alive and well here, and we love buying and selling stamps. We pay very, very, very good prices, so we'd rather buy 9 out of 10 collections than just a very small percentage of what we see. Also, check us out on our website at GaryPosnerInc.com. You'll see a lot of great stamps at great prices. And any questions, just feel free to call Bob at 1-800-323-4279. That's Bob Prager at 1-800-323-4279. And my cell number is 917-538-8133. Happy hunting out there.
Return to sender, address unknown, no such number.